Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Labyrinth in the News for Monday, October 26th. I'm your host, Christiana, coming to you live from the Couve, that's Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, Oregon, as I will be doing every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, soon to change to Pacific Standard Time in a few days. My lead-in music is the first cut off of Susan Alexander's CD, Sequentia, called Ecos, which is short for icosahedron, the water symbol in sacred geometry. Sequentia is music created from the recording of tones from vibrations from DNA molecules. Susan recorded these tones in 1988 with the help of Dr. David Deamer, at that time a cell biologist at the Davis campus of the University of California. If any of you would want to chat while we're on the air, please go to Christiana-Annea, that's A-N-N-A-E-A, at blogtalkradio.com. Today, I'm interviewing one of the workshop presenters at the Labyrinth Society Conference and Gathering that was held in Portland, Oregon 2 weeks ago. Her name is Jody Lorimer, and she gave a presentation on the topic of her new book, The Origins of the Labyrinth in Paleolithic Europe. And she is here with us today. Jody, are you there?
Tiana, can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. Welcome to Labyrinths in the News.
Thank you.
Well, I don't think I have the title of your book quite accurate. I don't have a book, one of your books in front of me. So could you please fill me in on what the actual title to your new book is.
Yeah, it's called Dancing at the Edge of Death, The Origins of the Labyrinth in the Paleolithic.
Well, this is really wonderful. I love that title. It combines this idea of artistry and artistic dancing, and then the symbolism of dancing with death, and then Paleolithic Europe. I mean, you know, that sounds like where is it joined? How are those two things related?
Dancing in the Paleolithic?
Well, dancing with death and Paleolithic and Labyrinth. So we could do this for an hour at least, right?
I think so, yeah. Well, it's complicated, but very basically the impetus for my writing the book in the first place was because I was curious about the origin of the symbol itself. And I couldn't really find a satisfactory answer to why, on the one hand, my background or my knowledge at the time of labyrinths came from Greek mythology that had a minotaur at the center of the labyrinth that would eat you. And yet here was this worldwide movement that really gained steam after Lauren Artress wrote her book, Walking a Sacred Path, where she began to use a labyrinth pattern as was done in the Middle Ages in the cathedrals of Europe, walking this labyrinth pattern as a meditational, spiritual focusing exercise. And I thought, well, how can you have a symbol that combines both this spiritual pursuit of God, of centering and peace and comfort, and yet on the other side have a cannibalistic monster at the center of the mythic labyrinth? And I needed to find what the origin of those two, what united those two ideas. And in order to see where they diverged, you had to find what the commonality was. That led me through, literally my own labyrinthine journey, back to the first modern humans who came to Europe from Africa during the Paleolithic at about 50,000 before the present, BP. And the dancing image comes from what I call the minotaurs that were drawn on the walls of Paleolithic caves that, to my mind, represent the shamans of the Paleolithic who were physically entering labyrinthine caves and encountering the spirit world there. And they, as shamans, trained themselves as shamans do now and have for all of modern human history to travel from this reality to an alternate reality that is going from this waking consciousness to an altered state of consciousness in which they commune with spirits or the dead or gods or helper spirits on the other side of a veil, a divider between this reality and that reality, and they're able to move from that one back and forth, back to this one, and bring knowledge gained from those journeys back here. So to me, all of those images on the Paleolithic caves looked like they were dancing. They have one leg raised, they have their arms out in front, or hooves as the case may be, and they appear to be dancing back and forth across that dividing line between this world and that world through what I think was the center of the labyrinth.
And so how does this relate to the actual myth of Theseus and the Minotaur? How does that relate to it in terms of the cave image or the symbolism of that?
Well, the caves are like minotaurs and like labyrinths, are archetypal symbols. They have to do, obviously, with dark, dangerous journeys, subterranean or subconscious journeys into another reality. In terms of the connection between the Greek myth and the Paleolithic, we're talking about literally tens of thousands of years of time going by from one to the other. If you you think of the origin of the Minotaur in Greek tradition goes back to their conquest of Minoan Crete and their adoption of what was the remnants of the Cretan civilization that had been destroyed by the eruption of Thera, Santorini. And they came in and took over the remnants of Crete and brought with them their imperialistic civilization that had to essentially discredit what was in existence in Crete. So they, for political, spiritual, religious purposes, they had to diminish the significance or conquer, if you will, the remnants of the survival of the Minoan cultures. So although in Minoan Crete, the idea of magical bulls or bulls as gods or goddesses were considered to be positive good, as we understand it from the archaeological record, positive things probably connected to the sun and moon. The Greeks came in and had to demonstrate their superiority, essentially, and so what had been considered a positive godlike power then became diminished as a perversion of the natural world, that is, the Minotaur. The Theseus myth puts the Minotaur in a position of having been born from unnatural urges, a curse, many negative images that occur. And Theseus, of course, is the Greek hero, the Mycenaean Greek hero, who comes in and saves the day by slaying the Minotaur in his labyrinth. And Theseus is helped by Ariadne, the princess of Crete. She gives him the magic thread that allows him to find his way back out of the labyrinth after killing the Minotaur, and he runs off with her and subsequently abandons her on the island of Naxos, but goes on to become the king of Athens. In terms of the relationship between the Paleolithic and the Minoan Crete, you have this idea of a composite of a bull and a man. And in the Paleolithic, that image indicates the ability of the shamans to move into a deep state of trance, which would allow them, as shamans report the world around, when they get into a very deep state of a trance, they then can transform into animals, into spirits, into plants, birds, and then adopt those capabilities of whatever that transformation allows them to do, to fly, to swim, to commune with the spirits. It appears that the most common transformation, at least that was represented on in the caves, was a combination of a bull's head and a man's body. And that idea of transformation, of metamorphosis, of channeling the power of a deity as a shaman, I think was carried on around the Mediterranean world, because you see in the mythology and in the artwork from Egypt to North Africa to Turkey, Çatalhöyük, and lots of different sites all around the Mediterranean world, there's a very common theme of bulls or cattle being incorporated as spiritual beings. And in Crete, you see this as well in the mythology of the Minoans that comes down to us in their artwork. We don't have any written literature from them, but then the Greeks transpose that into the Minotaur, who then has been demoted into this evil cannibalistic monster. He's no longer a powerful shamanic creature, because he's been replaced by the Mycenaean gods.
Well, okay. Wow.
Does that make sense?
So,
yes. Am I making sense?
But so what are the characteristics of that would make this the bull so important to the Minoans? What are the positive characteristics that were attributed to the bull?
To the Minoans?
Yes.
Well, I think it's probably a pretty common theme, again, throughout the whole of Europe and Africa around the Mediterranean, and that is that they were, these are not the bulls that we know today. These were, they're called aurochs. They're ancient oxen that actually survived until, I think, about 1600 when they finally went extinct. But they were much larger than the bulls we know today. They were maybe 3,000 plus pounds, and they had enormous horns, and they were very social animals. That is, they had herds, and they had, you know, mates and groups of young that they protected very very viciously. They were very stubborn, full of attitude, and very mean-tempered. So it took quite a long time and a lot of bravery, actually, to domesticate these animals. And when they were domesticated, as generally happens when you domesticate any kind of a wild animal, they slowly evolve into a smaller, physically smaller species. So I think they were not only good to eat, because that was certainly a part of it, but they also demonstrated a tremendous amount of power. Because we don't have any written sources to go on as far as the Minoans are concerned, we only see them sort of as a mirror reflection of what other people reported about them, like the Egyptians and the Greeks, and then based on what we see in the remnants of their art and what's found in the archaeology, there was possibly a connection between the bulls and, as I say, astrological or astronomical symbols of the sun and the moon.
And what about Taurus? What about the characteristics of the...
the constellation.
What about the Taurian? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is that probably any relation to this or the characteristics?
It may well be, because that was that derives from the Mesopotamians, and certainly the Mesopotamians knew, or the Greeks, the Egyptians knew what the Mesopotamians were doing, and the Minoans were trading with the Egyptians. So all of this information was no doubt flowing along the trade routes and being adapted and transformed from culture to culture. But there were some very strong similarities, religiously speaking, through all of those cultures. The bull has represented the powers of earthquakes, of the sun, of weather. The Apis bull in Egypt was raised as a representative of the god Apis and was sacrificed ritually, periodically. Bulls were mummified. They were protected. As I said, in places like Çatalhöyük in southern Turkey, you see these gigantic bulls painted on the walls. They enshrined the skulls and the horns in buildings in Çatalhöyük. And certainly bulls occur over and over and over again in Greek mythology. Zeus is the bull of heaven, as were the pharaohs of Egypt, called the bulls of heaven. So it's a very common theme that bulls, being very powerful, very virile, certainly very protective of their cows, their young. They were essentially very strong tribal animals that probably had a great deal of complicated symbolism for many people around the Mediterranean. The interesting thing in cave art is that it's not necessarily bulls that are pictured on the walls, but bison. They're bison men. But what happened at the end of the Paleolithic is, of course, the weather changed. There was a tremendous long period of time, a couple thousand years, where the Ice Age climate that had been so ferocious and so dependable for tens of thousands of years began to change. So there were these tremendous climactic fluctuations, and there would be a great period of time where there'd be temperate climates, and then it would go back to freezing, frigid cold again. The animals that had been so dependable in terms of migration and their presence and so on were not as dependable. The seasons didn't appear as dependably as they used to. So there was a feeling, I think, of tremendous chaos and anxiety of the world being kind of out of whack, pretty much as we feel now with climate change happening so dramatically. And at that point, the bison eventually migrated to the north and east into, you know, Poland and the steppe area, where it was still cold enough to support them. In the south, they died out. They due to climate change and hunting, bison were destroyed, and so, or rather, went extinct. And so, I think bulls began to replace them as the next powerful horned animal that filled all those cultural gaps, all those cultural needs for that symbol.
So, do you think that there is a connection then, that there actually is a logical connection to why supposedly there was a plate, a brass or gold plate in the middle of the labyrinth in Chartres Cathedral showing Theseus slaying the Minotaur?
Well, yeah, I don't know that anybody's really sure that's what was there, but that's what's assumed to have been there. Yes, I believe so, because that was the myth that came down to Western Europeans through Greek authors, historians, and playwrights, and so on. Numbers of them who incorporated the idea of a labyrinth as a dark, dangerous place in which you could get lost. You had to have a guide. And at the center, there was this monster that could conceivably eat you. And then, of course, the hero Theseus, being the perfect young man who would go in and save the day by killing this monster. demonstrating tremendous courage. So I'm not exactly certain how people in the Middle Ages understood that presence of the Minotaur at the center, except perhaps as, I think, probably horned, cloven-hoofed animals then became the model for Satan, for the devil. Animals that, you know, Satan has horns, he has a long tail, he has cloven hooves, so that it could be understood in the Christian tradition as overcoming sin, overcoming power of the devil by being heroic and exemplary in your spiritual life. That's a guess. I don't know for sure.
And Theseus would then be Jesus Christ. Or the son, you know, slaying the power of evil or something like that, or the son of God or whatever.
Possibly. Yeah, yeah. I think you could make that extrapolation. Of course, Theseus, as the prince of Athens, was a whole different kind of personality and a different kind of mythic presence than certainly Jesus. So it comes out of a different tradition. But the idea could be extrapolated as overcoming sin, overcoming temptation, however you want to typify what the monster would represent, you know, evil, bad stuff, you know, whatever it is. In terms of the myth of Theseus, the Minotaur actually is sort of a patsy. I mean, he had really nothing to do with anything. It was because King Minos opposed Poseidon, the god Poseidon. Poseidon was going to cut a deal with Minos, and it was Minos's idea. He said, "If you will, you will help me to demonstrate my power to my people, and I will show them how tight I am with you, Poseidon. So if you will send me a bull from the sea, for my people to witness that this, I call on you and you send me the bull, they will know how powerful I am and that I have the favor of the god. And then I, in turn, will sacrifice the bull back to you and we will have a sacred pact between us." Well, Minos saw this bull that Poseidon presented to him, as agreed, and it was so perfect that he got greedy. He wanted to keep it. So he kept that bull and he sacrificed a lesser one. Poseidon saw that that was the case, and he was understandably miffed. So he decided to get back at Minos by cursing his wife, Pasiphae, and he cursed her with an unnatural lust for this white bull that Minos had kept apart. And she talked to Daedalus and convinced Daedalus to build her a cow that she could hide in so she could mate with the bull, this white bull. The result was the Minotaur. So then Minos went back to Daedalus and said, "Build me a labyrinth to hide the Minotaur from the world and to hide my wife's shame." So what had been a positive, above-ground, sunny fields, good spiritual thing among the Cretan people, the people of ancient Crete, the Minoans, became a deep, dark secret that had to be concealed and hidden from the world in this deep, dark, dangerous place, the labyrinth. In Homer, in the Iliad, Homer describes a dancing floor built by Daedalus for Princess Ariadne that was in a field. It was out in the sunshine, and children, young boys and girls, danced holding hands, a very complicated dance on this dancing floor in the sunshine. And he didn't call it a labyrinth, but it became connected through the myth of Ariadne and Theseus and so on with this structure, this building called the labyrinth. So it had been an open-air dancing floor that then became transmogrified by the conquering Greeks into a dark, dangerous place.
Wow, that's so fascinating, Jody. Thank you so much for this information. It's really Rich, very rich. What did you do to research all of this? Did you actually go outside of the United States to do your research, and how did you go about doing that?
Well, initially, I was just trying to answer that first question for myself. How could one symbol contain both God and monster? And I just spent a lot of time reading on it, trying to, you know, following various logical paths of research to try to find, you know, the history of the symbol. And that led me back through the Greeks and studying the Minoans and this and that. And then I did make a trip to France. It was an archaeological tour where we toured a number of Paleolithic cave sites, many open to the public and others that were privately owned, that because we were on this tour and they'd done this before, we had access to them with wonderful guides. And I had suspected that maybe there was something fundamental about the idea of the labyrinth that was common to just humans and human structure, because if you follow, if it's something that it occurs in the idea of a labyrinth, and a labyrinth symbol or spirals or meanders occurs in art around the world, whether you're from South America or South Africa or Europe. And so there had to be something that was just, that was biological, that was neurological, that was as a common denominator in just humans, that made this idea universal. And while on this tour, I was able to spend a great deal of time talking with the archaeologist who went with us as a guide, Jim Kaiser, who's an archaeologist with U.S. Forest Service here in Portland, and a rock art expert. And we were very fortunate to be able to spend a day with Jean-Claude, who is he was the head of the Ministry of Culture in France, who was the go-to guy for all Paleolithic art in southern France. And he took us to Nyon. And I asked him at the time if he – I said, I think the origin of the labyrinth goes back to the first humans who came here to Europe, because they had the same brain structure that we do, the same optic nerve, the same biology. And he said he thought I was right, and I, yes, it's not just me. So seeing that artwork and being in the caves, having the experience of being in a cave environment, really helped me to understand how that idea combined with your biological response to that environment would put in place the idea of a journey in life and a journey in spirit through a dark and dangerous place.
Wow. Well, that sounds like a wonderful journey of yours that you've completed now with the publishing of your book. And congratulations, and best of luck and best wishes for lots and lots of books being sold.
Thank you very much.
We are pretty much out of time. I only have about a minute remaining. So do you have any quick impressions of your time at your Labyrinth Society gathering?
Quick impressions? Well, it was wonderful to be a part of all of these people. I'm relatively new to the organization, and only knew a few people here locally who were connected with it. But I was delighted to get to have a feeling of all of these people coming together who are really genuinely joyful, positive, uplifting, and just interested in exactly that. How, you know, they're totally tolerant, and what unifies them is this experience of finding a way through life, whether it be through trauma, divorce, health worries, issues in life, whatever, but the labyrinth as a meditational tool has been extremely successful for them as a method for them to examine and face and deal with difficulties in their own lives, and they're very generous in sharing those experiences.
Well, thank you so much, Jody. We're out of time. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to reading your book and adding it to my arsenal of must-have labyrinth material for my own workshops.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Christiana.
You're welcome. So long.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Labyrinth in the News in the live category on blogtalkradio.com with your host, Christiana Anaya. Stay tuned for next Monday's show when the guest is to be announced. And join us as we talk about more issues and more wonderful Labyrinth topics. Have a blessed week. In Lakesh.